Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Urban Studies. This is a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Anna Zhelnina, the host of the channel, and this interview today is being recorded in partnership with the Community and Urban Sociology section of the American Sociological Association and its academic journal, City and Community. And today I'll be talking to Felicity Chan about her new book, Tensions in Diversity, Spaces for Collective Life in Los Angeles. This book was published in 2022 by the University of Toronto Press. Felicity, welcome to the show.
Hi, Anna. Thank you.
You're very welcome and congratulations on the book. It's a big achievement. But why don't we start this interview with a small introduction? Tell us about yourself, a few words.
Sure, Anna. Felicity here, and I am speaking from Singapore. I'm a fellow at the Lee Kuan Yew Center for Innovative Cities at the Singapore University of Technology and Design. And I am born and raised in Singapore, but spent quite a bit of my life in the United States.
Right. And this book that we are going to talk about is about Los Angeles, where I understand you did your PhD there. And the book is based on a PhD project. So could you tell us how this project emerged and how did you transform your PhD into this book?
Well, so I guess the book started a long time ago. I think it's very much rooted in my experience of living in the U.S. As an international student, and through that, just experiencing the life of an immigrant. And then coming back in the mid-2000s after my master's in urban planning at Harvard, I came home to Singapore. And there, Singapore was also going through its own experience of immigration. During this time, what I got was being an outsider in American society and feeling that sort of how does an immigrant feel, I mean, to be outside, I mean, the kind of tensions that you have, right, not knowing how to articulate certain things. And then when I was back in Singapore, I was the insider, thinking about how this is a little strange. Our society is going through quite a lot of societal changes and there are new people. And I guess particularly at this point, there were a lot of Chinese immigrants in Singapore. And as many of you might know, Singapore is predominantly Chinese. I mean, it's multicultural. But I think that also started many people thinking, like, why is it that they are the same but not the same? and so I think this was all these sort of experiences that then led me, when I started my PhD at the University of Southern California, to think about that in the context of Los Angeles and I mean, in LA, is a place which is just exploding with people from all different parts of the world. And there I was, I mean, having already lived in America for about 5-6 years, and then in Los Angeles in a new city, and in between I was in Singapore. That really got me to think about how could we make the foreigner feel more welcome. So this project really started with how do we have more productive thinking and productive encounters with someone from the outside in a way that we could, you know, even through little small little conversations, we can make someone feel included in the society. So that was that basis. And I'm from urban planning. And so it really started me thinking, because a lot of discussions about foreign local relations were not about space. And I'm thinking like, look, is there something we can do about space? Because space, urban space is important. It is very central, at least to how I think about life. But I know it is also central in the way of what Amin talks about, the urban unconscious, right? So that started me thinking like, could I put these two interests of mine together? And the PhD project was born from that. But how the dissertation then became a book, that is perhaps an even longer journey. I didn't think of it becoming a book, right? From the outset. But I think towards the end of my dissertation, a professor of mine was saying, Felicity, why don't you think about making your research into a book? Because it sounds like this is something that requires a lot more pages to explain, to get the narrative across. So that started me thinking like, perhaps maybe let me go talk to the publisher during the conference. Maybe they might think this might be interesting. And so I did. The publisher's like, yeah, this is interesting. By the way, that was not University of Toronto Press. You know, at conferences, there's a lot of publishers. But I think that was enough to get me to like, perhaps I could give this a try. Never thought in my entire life that I would write a book, and even less so about a book about Los Angeles, somewhere that I was an international student, lived there for many years in Southern California, but never thought that I would write a book about it. So that was that journey.
I think it's very encouraging for all of us to hear that, all of us who are thinking of writing a book based on their PhD thesis. So it is possible and people can be interested in these projects. But why don't we talk a little bit about LA? Like, what makes it an interesting city? I mean, there's a lot of research on LA, right? But like, what makes it an interesting city for your particular project? What's it like? What are the neighborhoods where you worked?
Yeah. I mean, I think LA has a very special place in my heart. I think I will begin with, I think, my feelings about Los Angeles. So my first time in Los Angeles was in the mid-90s. I visited my brother who was studying there at that point, and I thought to myself, well, I never live in this city. I don't like it. It was a very different from the type of cities I visited. It just turned my urban sensibilities upside down. And I was not ready to accept it. But there came life, has this life and twist. I ended up in Los Angeles and for many years. And now I'm thinking of maybe I should visit Los Angeles this summer, right? Because it really does, has grown on me. And so when I first arrived there for my PhD, I think it was just simply its vastness that was overwhelming. And I know that this was also a place where it's extremely international. I have lived in Boston before that, and Boston itself is a microcosm of the world in many cases. But LA just blew my mind, I would say. It's the city that, why is it there's so much congestion, there's so much pollution, but yet so many people come? What is about it? And I've by then I've read a lot about stuff about written about LA, and I think that I have to say that although I did not, it's not my first love, it is something that has always been intellectually stimulating. And so why LA for the project? I think I was simply in LA, and LA presented itself as extremely diverse. LA was also a place where I think I have got this philosophy for myself as a researcher that I like to do research in the city that I live in. And so, I mean, with the questions I had then and with the place that I found myself in, I think then that just got me thinking. And of course, LA is a place that people talk about not having much of a public space mentality. And I think that that question is also addressed in the book, like what are the possibilities of local public places for intercultural learning? So that was how I started to study this phenomenon in LA and found a lot of interesting findings. Yeah.
Right. And in the book and in the project, you focus on three neighborhoods, right? And I think it's also, why did you choose these three? What are they like? And how are they special in terms of your research question?
Yeah. So it took me some time to find those neighborhoods. And they came or they emerged in a way that is not completely... it's more serendipitous. So the first neighborhood was Central Long Beach that I found. So I was doing a project with my advisor and a PhD senior there, looking at all these ethnic towns in Los Angeles. So Little Filipino, Filipino town, Little Saigon, and Cambodia town was one of them, and Cambodia town in Central Long Beach. And so I was there, I was like, oh, this is a very, very special place. So, you know, I'm from Southeast Asia, and when I was there, and I visited some of the shops, and there it was in 2010, the year 2010, and I was transported back to how shops looked like in Singapore in the 80s. So it was a very strange experience, both familiar, but also not. And I just felt like there was something in this neighborhood that I wanted to come back to. So that became the first neighborhood. And of course, in Cambodia town, what I found there was also that that it was not like many ethnic towns in Los Angeles. That's not the biggest population, right? Most of the populations were Hispanics. The Cambodians were large, I think 20%, but not the biggest. But it was called Cambodia. I mean, it is called Cambodia town. So something is going on. And I think usually that's how I like to go about my project. Something is going on. It's more of an intuition from anecdotal evidence. And I also found then like, okay, perhaps I should look for places where there are conflicts and tensions that are in the newspapers. So I started looking around Los Angeles. And then the next neighborhood was I found was San Marino. And San Marino, is extremely rich neighborhood, right? I mean, usually immigrant diversity, poor neighborhood. So Central Long Beach was below the annual household income, the average household income in Los Angeles County. And so this was like way high, right? So it's like, okay, I mean, I think that when I think about Los Angeles, I wanted to look for neighborhoods that represented what I was experiencing. Very poor neighborhoods, very rich neighborhoods. And so when I found the poor neighborhood, I also started looking at what are the other neighborhoods, and San Marino is a rich one. And over there, I mean, I also knew that there were problems, right, between groups. I was like, okay, let me go check this out. And I knew people who lived in that neighborhood. And so I thought maybe this might be a practical way, since at least I have a starting point to get the interviews going. So that then left me with the third neighborhood, right? Because I wanted it to be poor, rich, and maybe a mix. And so at this point, where could a mix be? And I was also advised, and my PhD advisor was like, maybe you should look for somewhere a little more accessible. And I thought that was an extremely good idea because LA has so much driving. And I think this was one of the challenges, practical challenges doing this piece of work, was I was driving a lot with congestion because Central Long Beach and San Marino were at least 1 hour away. And there was a day when I had some friends from the RC21 visit me in LA, and Anna knows some of them, and they wanted to see my sites, my few sites. So I drove them to San Marino and the Central Long Beach, and I was like, wow, this is really far. I mean, but thank goodness I never had to do that on a single day, but nevertheless, it was enough driving for the week if I had to go to both sites. So the third site was very close to University of Southern California, and this was also the Mid-Wilshire area, which is really right smack in the city of LA. And this place has like over 100 nationalities living in there. And in the book, I talk about how it's really a polarized neighborhood, but taken as a whole, it was that sort of mixed kind of neighborhood. And so that was how I found the third neighborhood. And I also knew that from reading the papers that there were some tensions between the groups there. There was the place of Koreatown and Little Bangladesh, and they were having some issues. But the more I dig, the more I found out other tensions, right? So that was it. Sorry, I mean, it took a while to explain the three sites, but yes.
Well, they're totally worth it, because also in the book you have such rich descriptions of those places, and I've told you earlier that I felt transported. Those are really great descriptions of those places, but maybe this is also a good time to discuss my next question, and this is how you conceptualize neighborhood and community, because those are not the same things for you, right? And you talk about neighborhoods, so you selected those physical kind of places, neighborhoods, but what about the community part of it?
Yeah, so that question, community versus neighborhood, is something that I think we can spend like 1 whole hour talking about. And I'm really thankful that very early on in this project, I have been asked this question. So I'm glad I didn't walk into a landmine to, you know, simply thinking that calling a community is the same as calling a neighborhood. So I think community is something that is defined from inside out, and neighborhood has a tendency to be defined from outside in. And so I was very careful. In fact, even the word neighborhood, I have a hard time using it. Should I use it? Should I not? Because it's just so value laden. Certainly, I cannot use community because, I mean, what do I know about the people there if I've not even studied it, right? How they think about who they are, how they group themselves, what are their commonalities. So in this case, the neighborhood, the term of the neighborhood, in the book, most of the time I refer to locales. I mean, this was a real struggle. I wanted something broad enough and not already defined by a researcher. But at the same time, how people talk about neighborhoods, right? If you ask them what is their neighborhood, they are not necessarily talking the way that planners tend to think about, which is often defined from outside in. They are also talking about their community. And it is tricky that way. And so there is that whole intellectual part about community versus neighborhood. And then when you have to put that in your interview schedule and your questions, what words should you use so that people understand what you're trying to ask? And by using those words, are you then giving them ideas of what you are actually trying to find out? So it was a struggle between community and neighborhood, but they are different things. And I hope the book avoided that landmine, and that I wanted the voices of the people to tell us what was community to them, what was neighborhood to them. And for that reason, part of the research project was also using cognitive mapping. And one of my questions is, trace out or circle out or whatever shape you want to, and where is your neighborhood? So I wanted to know how they define the neighborhood, how they think about their locale. So that was, I think, how I saw the difference between community and neighborhood. And certainly works by Talia Blockland, you know, reminded me clearly to be very careful when you do a piece of research about these kind of issues.
Great. And speaking of how you did your research, you have a very creative mix of methods in this project, right? Like, why don't you talk a little bit about that? How did you actually do the research?
Okay. I use cognitive mapping as quite a big part of this project, but that is combined together with semi-structured questions and interview, which oftentimes became in-depth interviews. I think there was one interview that ran into like 5 hours long, and it was crafted to be 1 hour and maybe 20 minutes, 15 minutes, but it went way past 5 hours. Then I did survey. I used survey and also a good share of ethnographic interview when I could not take up my recorder or start writing notes, you know, for many reasons. And I'll maybe talk a little bit about that in a bit, as well as participant observation. So these were the main methods. And I think let me start with cognitive mapping. So cognitive mapping, I've always been enchanted by it since I came across it when I was a college student, about Kevin Lynch and what he did. And to me, I wanted to study social space. And I'm also very enchanted by the works of Lefebvre about the production of space, about the three aspects of space. So I think it just dawned on me that cognitive mapping, right, like perhaps could be used. I mean, now I'm a lot more convinced. At the start of my project, I was like, yeah, I think maybe there's something here, right? The cognitive mapping could be a conceived space. It could definitely tell us how people navigate, which is what Lynch was trying to do. So their perceived space, their spatial practices can be recorded on the map. And the lived space, which Lynch did not quite explore it, but we know the lived space is something which is really important. And I think when I'm talking about tensions, right, I mean, that sort of relationships within in diverse locations, that lived symbolic space is extremely important. So I said, well, but cognitive mapping could tell you how people use space, where they go, why they go to certain things. If you combine it with questions, right, about their routines, about how they feel about living there. So I thought that was what I did. So using the method was also another something that required a bit of thinking, because if you're familiar with Kevin Lynch method, he was using, you know, blank sheets and you sketch on it, right? So you sketch how you move from this place to that. And what I wanted was, because I'm doing three neighborhoods and I wanted to be comparative. And since my intention was wanting to answer the question of, okay, now you found out all these things in my neighborhood, so what, right? That urban planner policy bit in me is like, I need to at least have some basis of comparison that is between all the three sites. I should use the same questions. I probably should use the same kind of maps, but of the different place. So I thought, like, let me use the street map, Google map. And knowing that people have problems with just sketching, right? Not everybody feels comfortable on a blank sheet of paper. I said, at least if you were to circle and draw lines, perhaps, and Google map by then, you know, people were comfortable looking at them. I said, let me try that. And even that was like, okay, let's use two scale. I mean, I was told, like, some people's neighborhood might be even bigger than the scale that you've chosen. So give them two maps. So this was a great advice from my PhD advisor who has used cognitive mapping in his own work before. Tridip Banerjee is my PhD advisor. I would say that the preparation of using the method took a while. The analysis of what then I collected took an even longer time. And talking about them in a way to weave them into the narrative was extremely challenging, so to speak. Okay, so that was cognitive mapping. I would normally, how I used it was I would go to a place, a library, and ask people a list of questions, like where they live, and to just break the ice and all that, and get them to map out where they go. So I could find out who are the people who go to certain places? Were there places of encounters where people of different ethnic groups and nationality groups would somehow at least be co-present, even whether or not they're talking. So that was one way for me to do that. So I think in the book, I describe my experiences there. I mean, I don't think I got greeted in the friendliest fashion all the time, because of course, there are many issues even as you do research in a diverse setting, right? I mean, I think I talk about my positionality as a researcher, and maybe you can talk more about it later. But anyhow, so the interview would normally take 1.5 hours because of the mapping. And then I would ask them if they could stay for a bit to do the survey, which is trying to understand their preferences and all their preferences for the type of public spaces to have the kind of encounters with different groups of people. It's really long. I think maybe I'll stop here.
but I think it is really important to talk about your methods because they are innovative and still comparative. I really like this idea of a comparative approach with the cognitive mapping part in it. But maybe you could just talk a bit about your positionality. You already brought it up because it was a big part of your research process. So what you also have a very interesting reflection on that in the book. So how would you reflect on your positionality in the field?
Oh, about my positionality. I think what was very interesting for me, I think I've learned a lot just doing research in LA and going to 3 different sites, is that they are mixed in all different ways, right? There are different groups of people living there in Central Long Beach. There were Cambodians and Hispanics. There were also Black Americans and some white. And San Marino is mainly very wealthy Asians, Chinese and white Americans. And Mid-Wilshire is like, we have a lot of others. And they're also socioeconomically different, mainly in terms of household income. And so here I am, right? I am not part of any of those 3 neighborhoods. I'm from the outside. I'm from the outside, right? In some neighborhoods, I look like some of them. In some neighborhoods, I certainly stand out like a sore thumb. And it doesn't help taking a camera around in some neighborhoods to take pictures, because it's like nobody wants to linger in a place when it's not safe to be in on the streets, right? And why are you taking pictures of things that perhaps are not even picture worthy? So that was a lot of awkwardness, so to speak. So maybe I'll speak about the different sites because they were all very different. And I think this was also a challenge of doing a comparative research across 3 sites with many different types of people who understand things a little differently. And what I thought makes sense in one location in terms of my questions did not make sense in another. The other group of people living in another neighborhood couldn't really understand. And so I did a fair amount of preliminary field work before I finally went out to collect the data proper. Okay, so in Central Long Beach, I think I spoke about how being raised in Singapore and being transported into bits of my childhood in the 80s. And so I think I described in my book that I'm 4th generation Singaporean and I'm Chinese, but I don't feel very Chinese in some sense. I mean, Chinese enough, but then I think I describe how when Chinese immigrants came from China, I started to feel like perhaps I'm not that Chinese. So in Central Long Beach, I encountered a lot of Cambodian seniors who I think really enjoy talking to me, right? Because they could they ask me if I could speak Mandarin, I could speak Cantonese, I could understand other Chinese dialects, and I could do about 2 or 3 of them. And so they were really happy. They were very open to talking to me, allowing me to sit with them during lunch. So I did a fair bit of that ethnographic interviews then. But yeah, and I think I also described that because of, I think, I don't know, maybe being fourth generation in Singapore, I sometimes can be mistaken in Los Angeles, oftentimes, that I could be Hispanic. So there I was in Central Long Beach. Some people, I mean, it was kind of a mixed looking person, I guess, in that way. Asian enough, but yet there is a trace of doubt that perhaps she's not, right? But of course, I couldn't speak Spanish. So there I felt welcome by the group of Cambodian seniors, but also because of, I mean, who I am. I mean, I do PhD research. I feel certainly more socioeconomically privileged in a poorer neighborhood. And I had to deal with my sense of just standing out, and I didn't, yeah. But that was overcome when the librarians there would open the library for me to do my research in, because I mean, it was also not a very particularly safe place, neighborhood at that time. There were drive-by shootings. I mean, there were gangs in their areas. And so, yeah, so that was that in Central Long Beach. I felt kind of at home, but not really at home. Then San Marino, I am Chinese. There are a lot of Asians there, but that number of growing number of Asians also created, I mean, was a source of tension, right? So I was very well aware that of that, and so I had to explain that, you know, I'm from Singapore, you know, so I'm not really the group of people represented there. So that hopefully that would ease the tension. But it really helped that I'm from the University of Southern California, because I think that's something they recognize. And some of them who I talked to were alumni of the university. So I think that opened some doors. So in that neighborhood, I'm not in that category of social economic class. I felt a little awkward too. And in that neighborhood, because it's not a neighborhood whereby people walk on the streets a lot, right? There's a main commercial spine. And so you don't bump into anyone. And doing interviews there is really by referral, right? You talk to someone say, okay, you can talk to someone else, and then you can, and so on and so forth. You don't go to a park. I mean, you hardly bump into anybody anywhere. So that was San Marino. And then Mid-Wilshire was, wow, I mean, I thought I was, by then, I've done the two sites, like, okay, I'm equipped. But in Mid-Wilshire, it was like you're in the middle of, I don't know, like Times Square or something like that. I don't know. I'm not that familiar with New York. But just having all kinds of traffic, like different people moving across, like, where do you even start? And so I started in the library, right? I found a library, and that was also part of the interview, or rather the research design, that I wanted to find out the possibilities of local places for meaningful encounters. And so in each of the sites, I made sure that there was a park, a public park, and a library, and a community club if possible. And so I started from the library. And from that library, I was then able to meet people from the Philippines, from Korea, from you know, I mean, there were also a few white Americans, there were Black Americans in there. There were people from where else? I don't know. I mean, like, from all walks of life, right, in the library. But yet I know that it's a bit of self-selection who turns up in the library. So I knew I had to go outside the library to look for other people. Well, I think, if anything, I think there was a park in Mid-Wilshire, which I felt extremely privileged as a woman. lovely park, a lot of children, and feels really safe. That's why they're there with their nannies and their parents. And I was able to walk into the playground, right, and ask if I could interview the parents. I think I wouldn't have the privilege if I was not, a woman. I think there was no questions. There were no shifting glances. I felt perfectly fine. And I think being Asian too, in the context of Mid-Wilshire, was helpful for me. I mean, for the people that I met from the Philippines, from Korea, who felt immediate, I think, connection to me. And being international was also helpful. I think that's one thing I want to mention here, which I did not expect going to the field, is that I felt like I had, I think, among the conversations, super good conversations with Black Americans. I mean, I think, although I have some Black American classmates, I mean, I have to say that, unfortunately, I have not had the privilege of knowing many of them as very close friends. And so conversations are also not as deep. But during this field work, I got to speak to several of them. And I think as I reflected about why our conversations has always just been so good and deep, I think it was also because that, perhaps because being a woman, being an outsider, perhaps being a minority, this was some of an equal status position that perhaps made them feel like they could open up to me. And their perspective on some of these issues was something that was very poignant to me every time that I got to do an interview with them. Yes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think it's very clear from your discussion of positionality how important this question was for your actual research theme, right? Because it's all about public places, intergroup relations, and it all reflects in your own being there. And I think it's so interesting that you start with a question like, where do I even find all these different groups? Like, how do I meet people in Los Angeles? And I wanted you to talk a little bit more about this. So your theme is intergroup relations, public places. So how, where's your contribution, and how do you see your main theoretical issues here?
I think this is always a something, I perhaps don't think about enough. It's almost like, okay, this is interesting. Let me go, understand this a bit more. I did not think so much about the theoretical conversation I was contributing to. I mean, but certainly I had to think about that, at least when it had to become a book, right? But as a PhD project, I think it was a great privilege that my advisor was just open to me doing anything that would interest me, and he can support. And so as long as we could, show which are the theoretical gaps, that's good enough. So I was very thankful for that. But I have to say, maybe the works of Ash Amin, I think the title, it was published in 2002, Ethnicity and in the multicultural world or something like that. And Leonie Center Cox's work on Towards Cosmopolis. Those were two foundational pieces that got me thinking, like, I want to do something about this, right? Because, I mean, they talk about how there were all these conflicts, tensions, and, I mean, how do we build something more beyond that? What they had was a description of what that thing could be. And I wanted to know as an urban planner, like how to make this happen, right? What are the qualities of space to do this? So I think they were extremely foundational for me, and I wanted to progress that conversation, right, to something a lot more tangible that planners can take it and do something about it. So I think if I would say this would be one of the major contribution of this piece of work that I hope I've done. And the other thing though is this, that I was in my undergrad trained as a geographer. And so there's this social science bit in me. And I just feel like with the years of being a planner, I think that sometimes planning tends to rush into things. They don't really quite understand the context, but let me give the solutions and here are the interventions. And this was very unsatisfying for me. And so what I try to do in this book is like, let me first go find out what is going on. And then let's see if we can find some form of, I wouldn't even call solutions, but at least some ways forward, right? To address some of these questions. So I think this is, I hope it's also a second contribution, which is kind of related to the first, that this book does not just stop at describing what is going on there, but it tries to say, let's see, you know, let's find some ways of moving forward together. So I think these are two main things that I thought about. Let's see.
But maybe you could talk a bit more about, what have you found? What aspects or what kind of features of urban space lead to intercultural learning, as you call it, or which features kind of facilitate more conflict and antagonism? So what are those aspects of urban space?
Yeah, so I think one of the, thanks for asking that question. Sometimes, I get carried away in one direction. I was like, I think I forgot what Anna asked, but thanks for repeating. So one of the happy outcome of this piece of work is I was happy to engage with the work of Kevin Lynch, Image of the City, to then look at how different are the images of a diverse city, right? I mean, he did his work in the late 50s and early 60s. And so I think if anything, this book, which is the focus on diversity as a social spatial phenomena, not just social or simply spatial, but social spatial, tries to then, you know, put together what are some of these like spatial forms, right? That are grown out of people's practices. Our paths that important, I think his image of the city had like five elements. And what I found was that places of locales of diversity, districts are extremely important. You know, people are grouping themselves. There are territories there. There are a lot of unseen boundaries, so to speak, right? Most physical, it's physical, but it's invisible. Unless you live in a neighborhood, you know what streets not to walk on. And so I think to do sensitive planning in those places, I think we need to recognize that space matters. How people group themselves, and there's tons of edges, right? A lot of borders within what we think is a coherent neighborhood, but actually is broken into many pieces and they're overlapping. And I think this is what I found. And so what does that mean then, right? I think one of the big deal is this. I talked about it as like eight place qualities that we should think about. So one of them, which extremely important, is safety. Safety came up as top in Los Angeles. I don't know if it looks a little different for other places, but you need to feel safe in order to feel that you can open up to a stranger. And safety is, for that reason, maybe is extremely obvious, but I'm glad that I systematically, I mean, I did a systematic research and analysis to find that out. So you need to feel safe to open up, and you need to have programs to help you open up. So you need a trigger. And I think this is something that oftentimes in urban planning, we just plan the space. And then we're like, we cannot be social engineers. We shouldn't disturb how people, we cannot control how they do. Let us just step back. No, but I think what this shows that people need help. Not everybody has got like competences to navigate that sort of borders and boundaries between cultures, right? And so give them some help. You need to organize some programs to trigger conversations for them to feel not awkward starting a conversation with a stranger or a familiar stranger. I think the other thing, what was very important is this, that that in these places, you need to have good access, accessibility, not just simply is nearby, but people feel comfortable being in that space. It needs to be neutral, right? I think these places, we know that if it's going to be a local public place, you want them to, everybody, every group should feel welcome. And I think if they don't, likely some groups would not turn up. I remember I had to do, one of the things was I was going around to the public parks, and one of the public parks I went to just to take a look at it and to see if I can find somebody to talk to during one of my field work in Central Long Beach. I walked in the park and immediately I was picked out. Someone came over to the park and said, like, what are you doing here? It was like 2 p.m., you know, there were kids playing around. I thought it was safe enough. But no, I mean, there was a whole group of people in the park doing something. And one person came over and asked me, what are you doing here? So I explained myself and tell them what I'm doing. And I said, oh, okay, you know, that's fine. You can hang around here and ask a few more questions. And then I knew that I was not obviously very welcome, right? And I could imagine that when there are too many of a group there, it could feel threatening. I was already kind of threatened, but I went ahead anyway because I was like, I need to talk to more people. So I just, but you know, so that was my experience. I think it needs to be neutral, but how do you achieve that neutral feeling? I think it's a challenge. When you have many people are trying to have some kind of spatial claims on space in a diverse neighborhood. I think the other things are perhaps very common sense that I found. I mean, food gathers people. If you allow, you know, people to share food, there's some commonalities. I mean, the other thing I also noticed that having dogs, right, or children, like what we call props, really help to get a conversation started. I mean, I think as adults, we tend to become more reticent, that we don't want the attention on us. But if the attention can be on a third object, at least that's an icebreaker moment. So these are some of the examples that I've, I mean, not examples, I think qualities that I found after talking to, I think, over 100 people, that they were just recurrent patterns. Yeah. So, yeah. I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. Yeah. But I want you to talk a bit more about tensions and conflicts, which are not the same thing in your book, right? And what are they like in those three different neighborhoods? Because they also kind of have different conflicts brewing in them. So what can you tell us about those?
Well, okay. So I always feel like tensions is like something of like an intuition. It's like a feeling, right? You feel it. You can't quite put words to it. And conflict is something that normally you can see it. It becomes a lot more obvious. And I think for this reason, it's been said that tension by Lewis Worth, right, who did his piece, I think, in 1940, the project, that is basically tension. Tension is latent conflict. So conflict that is about to happen or could happen. So I think these are two different things. And I feel like on the everyday basis in living in diversity, there's always like this feeling that you cannot be too comfortable. I mean, you might offend somebody. or you might feel marginalized in some circumstances, or you might just feel like, I don't like how that person is behaving, right? Like that kind of thing is like, you don't talk about it, you just feel it. So I feel like, so I think the word tensions really get across at this kind of very almost mundane, banal complaints that we have that are silent. But we also know that when you allow that to happen between friends, between couples, that can escalate into something bigger. So can we, you know, start to recognize some of these tensions and let's do something about it, right? But now I wanted to say that too, that conflicts like tensions are not necessarily bad things, right? I mean, I think we've read enough from intellectual discussions to know that they can be creative. They can allow us to then confront certain things that we shared before it becomes like a meltdown. But it can also be destructive if it's just ongoing, right? With no possibility of finding some form of productive resolution. And I want to add a bit of a personal take on this. I mean, being, I think, raised as an Asian, in the Asian society, harmony is very much like just regarded very highly. And I know I'm using Asia in a very broad sense because Asia is huge, right? But in that part of Asia that I grew up in, conflicts are bad things. You know, I mean, tensions are everywhere, right? Because conflicts are bad things. So you must not say anything. So there's a lot of, you know, dysfunctional families. I mean, at least you just don't talk about problems. You're not supposed to wish them away. And so it took me a long time to just come to terms with myself that tensions can be a good thing. And I think this is something I've talked about in the book. Tensions can be a good thing, but when does it become bad? when is it, you know, dualistic tensions? I think I talk about them is when it's an either or, it starts to be bad because you couldn't build any more consensus. But if it's dialogical, at least there is a possibility of finding a way forward. So these are the two concepts for me and how I thought about them when I worked on the project.
Could you give an example from one of the neighborhoods or maybe even a comparative example of how this actually plays out in the urban spaces?
Okay. We talk a little bit about this just now, about how after you've written something and it's so long, it's like, wait a second, I have to recall this. Like to see.
Yeah, I thought it was just so interesting that in the rich San Marino neighborhood, it looked so different from, let's say, Central Long Beach, just the questions and kind of the topics that are at the core of those tensions. So, but maybe we can leave it for the listeners to read for themselves in your book. Maybe another thing that I thought was interesting, and maybe you could just talk about it a little bit. You spoke to the people from different groups, right? Different ethnic and racial groups. And I thought it was so interesting that white residents, especially in those kind of better off neighborhoods, they had a very different account of how intercultural and how kind of dialogical their neighborhoods are. So do you have an explanation for that? I don't think you talk about it too much in your book, but I'm sure you have ideas for why white residents have a more positive idea about their neighborhoods.
Yeah, I guess I'll start with Mid-Wilshire. Mid-Wilshire was a neighborhood where I met people, white Americans who are there for the diversity. So they weren't thrown into that area. I mean, of course, in Mid-Wilshire, in the book, you'll see that there's the very wealthy part and the part that is not, and the part that is kind of in between, like just a few street blocks. And the white Americans I talked to there chose Mid-Wilshire for that diversity. It was voluntary. Now, I mean, that, of course, wasn't the case for the other people who I spoke to. Not all, but most of them, you know, are there because they don't have a choice, right, to live anywhere else. And And I mean, I think this is a really good question you asked, because why I think it's like, so I thought about it, and that I think it's the fact that you could choose, you have a choice to engage or disengage. And I think choice means a lot when it comes to being open to meeting somebody who is different and wanting to do it. You're not being, you know, it's not, you know, push into it, and then whether you like it or not, you have to deal with it. I think that already sets the tone. But I think the other dimension is also that all the other non-white people, not all, but that many of them are immigrants. Some are first generation. Many of them I talked to first generations, and there were some second generations, Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans, but I think that what is going on here is this: that as an immigrant, especially the first generation, you might not feel like you belong. So you have just arrived, or even you have been there for 30, 40 years. This is, you know, I mean, it's home for 30, 40 years, but you don't feel like you're being fully accepted. And I think that feeling of not being part, like wholeheartedly part of the mainstream, perhaps make you feel like you're not as comfortable just wanting to be reaching out. I think I talk about safety, about comfort. I think when you are comfortable in your own skin, in a place, I think that's when you are ready to go out. And I think which makes intercultural learning very difficult to happen. And that's why it needs quite a bit of help. So I think that could be the reason that I don't feel like I completely belong. And I think even in the case of San Marino, you would imagine that being socioeconomically at par with the rest of America or even above, you could belong. You have elected to belong in San Marino. But when you talk to them, you realize that their belonging for the first generation is very selective. Like, you must also feel like you're accepted. And not everybody, in fact, most of them don't feel 100%. And I think for that reason too, I think the other thing is also language. I mean, English is the main language of use in America, in most parts. And I think if you can't speak the language as fluently or as clearly, you might feel a little awkward to engage fully. I don't have an American accent. And so there are times when I myself feel awkward speaking because, you know, people pick you up. I think I talk about this LA small talk in the book. And in LA small talk is like an icebreaker, right? People are checking out who you are, and my accented English gets picked up all the time. And I don't think I really enjoy it particularly, but I think this is a reality of living in America. Having said that, I think that I also give a very positive way of looking at LA small talk, that LA small talk can be an effective icebreaker. Having said that, I think when it goes on for too long, life in LA can feel like a forever cocktail party. Having a hard time to, you know, build real deep friendships, and that can be frustrating, and I think that can be alienating. But I think, like what I said at the start of this conversation, is that if we can even give, at least begin to give some hope of inclusion, then it is a start, right? Then LA small talk can be that someone from the mainstream or whatever, how you conceive the mainstream or part of the neighborhood, is talking to you. And of course, some are, you know, not just simply being, you know, that friendly or wanting to talk, but checking you out. But there's all these different kinds of things. So yes, So this is what I thought LA small talk can be good for.
Yeah, I really like your discussion of LA small talk in the book, because it's one of those mechanisms, right, that kind of foster intercultural learning. But speaking of other things that may or may not help, you also have a discussion of intercultural festivals, or what are they called, like those celebrations, public celebrations of different cultures. But you have a very skeptical account of those. So why is that?
I think I have to say this, that I think there are very good ways of highlighting or spotlighting on the diversities, right, in a locale, in a city. But they often stop at that, right? You know, they have people come and show you, okay, this is what we eat. I mean, that's almost like it could even create some form of like stereotypes. it could, you know, when you push it to its limits. And it stops there. It's like a few hours on a Saturday morning. And what do people do with that? I mean, it has a lot of potential of just bring about forming new relationships, because you do meet people, they talk, there's always food, and you exchange phone numbers or something like that. And then from there, you could go and develop a deeper relationship. So I think it has the potential. But oftentimes, how do we go to those festivals? We often go with friends, you know, likely, you know, people we are really comfortable with, for that reason, because we know we are going to feel uncomfortable in the crowds of strangers from everywhere. And so most of us don't actually break out of our friends. You know, we just sit with our friends and then we go back with our friends and then nothing happens. And then, well, I guess the wherever that is, we'll say, okay, we have done this cultural thing, you know, check. But what actually happens the day after? Nothing has changed. Perhaps nothing has changed. Maybe in some small ways it has. So I think that it has a lot of potential to spark conversations. But I think conversations needs to carry on. It needs to be an everyday thing. But most of the cultural festivals don't do that. It's a good starting point, but it's not sustained. And I think I talked to the people there who attended year after year the same parades and festivals, and they tell me that, you know, I go with my friends, I sit with my friends, and my friends are usually from my own ethnic groups or nationality groups, and then, you know, that's it. We don't meet anyone else. So, yeah.
All right. But to kind of summarize our conversation a little bit, so what do you think are the main takeaways from your research that maybe urban planners can work with to make it more kind of interculturally friendly? What do you suggest to planners and designers?
So I think that we probably hear that a lot already, but I guess I would just say it again, that oftentimes when we think about planning public spaces, we think of them as public spaces, you know, space, physical space. But I think I talk about trying to design for public life. You know, you're talking about the activities there, the people who can come. And I think this is something that I hope that the book has actually tried to bring this across. And I think what I've thought about is also, why is urban planning profession and the type of things we do tend to get stuck in a certain way of thinking. So for this project, I also talked to planners and municipal offices, right, in the three neighborhoods. And what I hear there is that diversity, in this case of like social cultural diversity, is really think of as a mix. And we know mix is such a broad word. What does it really mean? And I think, it just does not go beyond that. You know, it's a nice social mix, and the planners just end there. So I think, the other thing is a nice social mix. So, you know, this could be a advantage for economic development. So I think it's all those terms that bring across that diversity is an advantage. So less about what, less about the difficult things about diversity. And I think this is what I try to get across in this book. It's actually very hard to deal with. And I think planners kind of subconsciously recognize that. And with all these movements these days, talking about marginalization, it is indeed a can of very difficult issues once you open it. So I think, and part of this, and because of this, this whole way that we, when we think about planning, there's a tendency to just, let's just focus on the hardware because we can deal with where we want to put the paths. But where people want to walk, who is going to walk on it, let us not get too much involved. And I mean, planning has a tendency to shrink back at this point, even though it has started with, it has always been about social, about social reform, social planning. So I think this is one aspect. I think the other thing that I thought about is this, that planning doesn't think about relationships enough. It's thinking about how land use and functions relate, but not how people relate. And I think at the heart of planning and designing for public life, you have to think about who gets along well with who and why, and why here and why over there people seems to be getting along fine. It's the same group of people. And I don't think we spend enough time thinking about this. I mean, having worked as an urban planner, I know life as a planner can be already very chaotic. There's very little time other than firefighting to think about this. So how practical is this project going to be taken by a city to then look at how they can improve their situation? I hope that this book has made it a little easier, because I'm very happy if you take what I've come up with, the methods, and use it. So hopefully this could, I mean, add to that sort of thinking and the type of solutions that we can find to have cities that are productive, that we can have collective life, even though we have tensions. Negative thought. How do we turn those negative thoughts about each other to something productive and positive? I think this is what I have always wanted from the start of the project, and I hope I've managed to achieve a bit of it through this book.
Right. I think this is a great hopeful note to wrap up our conversation. And thank you so much, Felicity, for your time and for sharing your insights with us. And best of luck with your next projects. Take care.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.